This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Hiking in state parks is popular in the summer months. How does Connecticut's budget impasse impact recreation around the state? Coming up, we'll hear from the Connecticut Forest and Parks Association. Now, as you walk through local woods, did you ever think about the trails or paths that existed long before the settlers came to North America? Today, Where We Live, we hear about efforts to recognize and map the trails of Native American tribes. Later in the show, we'll learn more about the trails Connecticut tribes used and what discoveries today tell us about the tribe's beliefs and customs. Now, author Robert Moore wrote a book called On Trails, and it explores how trails help us understand the world. In the book, he writes, few Americans can say with certainty that they've seen an old Native American trail, but everyone has seen the ghost of one and even traveled along it. Our next two guests know quite a bit about Native American trails, and they're both North Carolina residents. Joining us by phone now is Lamar Marshall. He's Resource Director for Southeast Heritage. It's a group dedicated to reconstructing historical landscapes. Lamar, welcome to the show.
I'm pleased to be here.
Also on the phone with us is Dr. Brett Riggs, a research archaeologist and Sequoia Distinguished Professor of Cherokee Studies at Western Carolina University in Cullowhee, North Carolina. Dr. Riggs, welcome to the show.
Hello. Glad to be here.
I'll start with Lamar. Take us back in time when the Southern Appalachians were home to the Cherokee Nation. How extensive were these trails?
Well, there was a huge infrastructure of these trails that connected to all the other trails, that basically a continental-wide trading and trail system. But there's some of the trails here are very, very important. And Dr. Riggs is going to... In fact, I think it'd be best if we let off with Dr. Riggs to give us a background on these trails that he's worked on. Then I'm going to give you a more of a general history of what I've done. Is that okay?
That's sure. I understand that Lamar's walked a lot of these trails. But Dr. Briggs over at Western Carolina University, you've studied these trails, also the Eastern Band of the Cherokee Nation for some time. Tell us about the trails and how they were developed.
Well, if you think about the trail system or this whole matrix, this network that cross cut the entire continent. Many of these were founded upon what had initially been the animal paths that took the routes of least resistance across the landscape. And when the first peoples entered this continent, you know, they already found established routes used by particularly larger, what they would view as game animals, that interlinked the entire area. And so many of the oldest trails that native peoples used were already in place when they arrived and found them. And native peoples, particularly Cherokee folks here in the mountains, often thought of these trails as being an integral part of the landscape, not necessarily even of a cultural construction, but something that was just an inherent and implicit part of this landscape, that such that everything was viewed as being held together by paths. Even the routes that fish in the water took, they followed certain trails. Everything was conceptualized in terms of trails, so that even in a broader sense, you know, if you look at the construction of the native cosmos, the upper world, the world above, is linked by trails. The Milky Way is a trail. The lower world, the world beneath, is all linked by trails, and so this world is just the same as that. So these trails were seen as being a very natural part of the landscape and a very important part of the landscape to Native peoples.
When we're talking about trails, so following the river or following ridges?
Both. You have ridgetop trails interconnect places that are, you know, perhaps separated by ridgelines here in the southern mountains. So there would be trails that would follow ridgetops, trails that would cross-cut the grain of the mountains, and trails that would follow watercourses as well.
Now, Lamar, also on the phone with us, you've been surveying these trails for some time, walking many of them. How did this start for you?
Well, I guess about 50 years ago, I started really studying the old maps, records, and journals so I could produce modern maps with the old trails and trail corridors, Native American towns and settlements. But when I was very young, I was very fascinated with the lifestyle of Native Americans because I could see, you know, we grew up in a corporate world and structured, and you have to go to work every day, and the Native Americans seemed to be one of the freest peoples on earth before they became involved in trade with the Europeans.
Now, Dr. Riggs was talking about how these trails and the meaning of the trails in Native American culture. But when you're looking and going into the woods to try to find some of these old trails, are many of them covered up now? I mean, when we look at our modern transportation system, some of the roads in our states may have followed these trails as well?
Absolutely. I would say that there's very few intact premier segments of the trails left. One trail in North Carolina is called the Unicoi Turnpike that Dr. Riggs has well documented through early surveys. But where you find your best examples, if they're still around, are on national forest, on public lands, because they have obviously not been developed and they were, you know, kind of set aside. But I would say that the native trails and their or the, I'd call it the blueprint or the circuitry of our modern road system. Because you'd have an animal trail, it became a Cherokee trail, and then the first white settlers would come in and they would widen these trails into wagon roads or turnpikes. And then later on, they got paved and et cetera. So it's an ancient road system that's been here for a long, long time.
How has the landscape changed? When we mentioned taking us back into time when the Cherokees walked these trails that they created, what did they see? What did the forest look like back then, and how has it changed today?
Well, that's one of the interesting things in the work that we do is a lot of these records and historical maps teach us about the ecology of, and I focus on around 1700 onward myself. But you find that in the early days, that the trees were much, much larger in the mountains. They'd never been cut. There was grasses growing 3 or 4 or 5 feet high sometimes in the forest because millions of passenger pigeons would light in the trees and fertilize the forest. You had the American chestnut that was obviously a huge resource for the bears and the turkeys and animals. And when the chestnut disappeared, of course that kind of crashed a portion of the ecosystem. But you have what you call ecological engineers, the beaver, they, you know, dammed up the waterways and the passenger pigeons. And then the Native Americans themselves were ecological engineers because they used fire to burn, especially like in Tennessee and Kentucky where you had grasslands. They burned the land in order to produce more grass for the buffalo and the animals they hunted.
And so today we might see a lot of these thickets that wouldn't have existed when the Cherokee were in the woods, making sure that they were, as you said, were burning certain areas to make it a little bit easier?
Well, I guess sometimes they'd burn for just to keep the underbrush down or the insects down. But one thing that in this part of the country, there was a lot of wild strawberries. And in order for these strawberries to continue to be like a strawberry plains, as they call them, they would burn that. But they didn't do a lot of burning in the high mountains down here because there wasn't any reason to.
This is where we live. Today we're looking at efforts to find old Native American trails and map them. On the phone with us is Lamar Marshall, Resource Director for Southeast Heritage and a North Carolina resident. He's walking a lot of these trails, helping to find them, old Cherokee trails in western North Carolina. Also on the phone, Dr. Brett Riggs, a Sequoia Distinguished Professor of Cherokee Studies at Western Carolina University in Cullowhee, North Carolina. Dr. Riggs, how are you working with Lamar as he's finding these trails, comparing old maps and working with what he's finding on the ground? What are you doing in terms of helping him with this project?
Well, we work with many of the same resources, and our foci are similar. I'm primarily involved in documentation efforts for the Trail of Tears National Historic Trail. And in western North Carolina, we have remarkable set or remarkable sets of documentation that assist us in that effort. So I'm focused on landscape reconstruction for a moment in time, whereas Lamar has a much broader view there. But the work that we do, each informs the other in terms of our understanding of the landscape, because the landscape that existed in the 1830s at the time of the forced Cherokee deportation from the southern mountains is, of course, a landscape that is developed for millennia. And Lamar's work helps to bring into focus the entire transportation network that was then used and exploited at the time of the Cherokee removal.
And how are you both working with members of the Cherokee tribe? What is their reaction to this project? Again, mapping out these old trails, land that was once theirs that was taken away.
Well, I think what we see is that the lands for particularly the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians, a federally recognized tribe here in the southern Appalachians, that their world, their landscape, has been so circumscribed historically through the 19th century and into the 20th centuries that what our efforts accomplish is to give folks sort of access to their historical landscapes again, so to create at least a cognitive reclaiming of this landscape as theirs, this place that was theirs for hundreds and thousands of years, to allow sort of a reclaiming of a sense of belonging and ownership on these places from which they have been at least legally alienated for 175, 200 years in some cases.
And Lamar Marshall, again, your resource director for Southeast Heritage, I believe some of the members of this group are also members of the Cherokee tribe. Their reaction to your work and how they're contributing to it?
Well, I'd say that the last 8 years I've been funded by the Cherokee Eastern Band through their Cherokee Preservation Foundation. And Brett Riggs and I both are involved in their GIS program. So what I'm doing is taking 8 years of work and building story maps that be online that can be used by teachers, by anybody in the tribe, and other people also, where they can have a graphic, interactive map. And, well, let's put it this way. You get online, and there's a story, say, of a Cherokee territorial claim, 1700, in the ecology. These story maps have a panel on one side, and you can have videos, images, graphics, connections to other sites, and then the bigger part of the screen has a map that is interactive. You can zoom in, and there's the Cherokee trails, there's the towns, and you can, and they can actually get in there and move around. This is an incredible resource.
And I'd asked this earlier, Lamar, about the process, and you said that you compare a lot of the old maps. When you're out in the woods, are you literally drawing what you're seeing in journals? And how do you translate all that you're discovering to then work with Dr. Riggs in this digital mapping project?
Well, as a background in surveying, I carry a field book with me and a GPS, of course. But first of all, you have to determine where a trail might be or might not be. I use historic maps from before 1700 to present. We dig out early surveys where they actually went out and surveyed tracts of land, and it says cross the Indian Trail at this point. And you got two different systems of the meets and bounds in North Carolina, but in Alabama, where I worked, the land is in sections, townships, and ranges, and the surveyors were meticulous sometimes to detail where a trail crossed. I dig out oral testimonies and chronicles. And one of the most valuable things is to find diaries and journals, particularly some of the military journals, that document mile by mile exactly, like in 1761, 1776, where they traveled and describe the landscape. Mm-hmm. And so I take all of this, determine where a trail might be, and if it goes down a valley, I start on the ridgetop, and I'll transect from one ridgetop to the other to see if I can find an original trail in the bottom. In many cases, they've been destroyed by logging operations. So it's when you find a premier section. It's a big find. But that's the, and then I, of course, GPS it, come back and put it into GIS and document it.
As you walk through the woods, you know, you're talking to us here in Connecticut. A lot of people enjoy hiking, but I don't think they're thinking about the trails that were once there from the indigenous people many, many, many years ago. What would you say to the hiker the next time they're out in the woods? What should they look for as they're we're more used to the conventional hiking trails, the wider trails that are much easier to walk on than, say, these old trails that you're finding?
Some of these old trails are so overgrown with rhododendron and other things that it'd be hard to even follow them. And some of them are being considered by the Forest Service that is to designate them, document them, and then open them for people to walk on. But a hiker just walking through the woods would need to know, have something in his hand, you know, to know where there was a trail. And I'd say one of the most important things, if you're hiking on one of these old Indian trails, as you're seeing the mountains, you're seeing the exact perspective that these early Native Americans saw when they walked those trails. And I have a map of trail in Alabama where Davy Crockett went during the war, went down the Black Warrior's Path, and I found premier sections of that. And when you're standing in a path and you know that, you know, Davy Crockett was there or Dragon Canoe walked this exact path, and that you're seeing the same things they saw, it kind of takes you back into time.
And Dr. Riggs, as people walk through the woods, whether it's in Connecticut or Western North Carolina, are there certain markers they should look for, or certain trees that may have been bent at one time that was a marker for a Native American as they were using these trails?
Well, I think not so much in the vegetation, because that has changed so dramatically in the 20th century. But sometimes you'll see rock piles or cairns that are trailside and mark trail locations or important locations along trails. And quite often, if these trails have been used for many hundreds of years, they're entrenched. So they're sunken roadbeds or sunken trail beds that you'll follow. Sort of cross-cut the slopes in ways that erosional features would not. And so, for instance, in documenting segments of the Unicoi Turnpike Road, which was, it was an ancient road across the southern mountains, an ancient trail, archaeological sites along the trail indicate its use for at least 10,000 years. But it was developed in the early 19th century as a commercial wagon road, and that development had created a roadbed that in some places is several feet deep, so it looks like almost a small canal across the southern mountains. We're working to document the entire span of this road, about 120 miles across the southern mountains. And ultimately, we'd like to see at least portions of it available for public use there. But it's marked, its very presence is noted by the passage of wagons, hundreds of wagons, hundreds of thousands of head of livestock across this one narrow corridor across the mountains. Mm.
Sounds like really extensive work. Anything like this being done in other parts of the country, Dr. Riggs?
There is, in fact, really all across our country, many efforts that are sponsored by the U.S. Forest Service and the National Park Service to document at least some of the more important transportation routes across the country. For instance, the National Park Service has a long-distance trails office that manages historic trailways across the country. So you see El Camino Real, the Santa Fe Trail, and various routes like that are important to our history as a nation. And I think Lamar and I would assert that these native trails that predate the European arrival are equally important to the history and heritage of our nation.
And I think we should stress, Lamar, and I think you touched on this earlier, when you do discover these trails, depending on the communication with the Forest Service, you're working to keep parts of these areas from being logged and these trails from being destroyed?
Well, one of the things that came out of my work was I identified about 150 miles of trails and potential trails or trails corridors on the National Forest. And I took GIS maps, and you submit them to the U.S. Forest Service, and they automatically put this into a cultural resource protective type of management. And before they would go in and do any timber management or road building, they would go send out people out to do a field survey and check these and determine what the significance of the trails are. Some of them were, you know, maybe completely eradicated. Some of them I found are under U.S. Forest Service timber collector roads. They were just adapted by the, you know, Forest Service. So, but there is an effort going on right now in the new forest plan of North Carolina to protect every Cherokee trail that can be identified on the National Forest.
And you've been doing this for some time. After you turn in the data to the Cherokee Nation, what's next for you, Lamar? I know you're a conservationist.
Well, I'm going to continue my historical research and continue the same work because in the course of this, in the last 8 years, I've got over 100,000 digital images of archives, historic maps, and maybe I'll write some e-books or something.
Well, I want to thank Lamar Marshall, Resource Director for Southeast Heritage. He lives in North Carolina, and we appreciate your time talking about the work you're doing, Lamar. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Also, Dr. Brett Riggs, Lamar's working with him to digitize these maps. Again, the data will be given over to the Cherokee Nation. Dr. Brett Riggs, Sequoia Distinguished Professor of Cherokee Studies at Western Carolina University in Cullowhee, North Carolina. Dr. Riggs, very important work. Thank you so much for telling us a little bit about it.
Thank you, Lucy.
And I do want to recommend this book on trails and exploration by Robert Moore. And he has a chapter here where he walks with Lamar Marshall. You can look that book up as well. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Many Native American tribes lived in Connecticut. After the break, we'll learn about them and their trails. And you can join the conversation, too. Have you thought about the paths the Native Americans once used in the woods you now visit? Join the conversation. 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Earlier, we learned about efforts to map Cherokee trails in western North Carolina. Have there been similar efforts here in Connecticut? And what discoveries have been found in local woods and along the rivers that have helped archaeologists and others understand the indigenous people that once lived in our state? Joining the conversation now is Lucy Ann Lavin, or Lavin, Director of Research and Collections at the Institute for American Indian Studies in Washington, Connecticut. She's an anthropologist and archaeologist, author of Connecticut's Indigenous Peoples, What Archaeology, History, and Oral Traditions Teach Us About Their Communities and Cultures. Lucy Ann, welcome to the show.
Thank you for asking me.
And pronounce your last name for me.
Pardon me?
Pronounce your last name for me.
Oh, it's Lavin.
Lavin, okay. And then also joining the conversation, Kevin McBride, Director of Research at the Mashantucket Pequot Museum and Research Center. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I'll start with Lucy Ann. Let's talk about the old trails here in Connecticut when we're looking at the Native American people. How extensive were they and how were they used, Lucy Ann?
Oh, they were extensive. Most of the trails are now part of Connecticut's transportation system, the old Berkshire Path, which connected the Stockbridge Christian Indian village of the Mohicans, actually led southward and connected Scaticook, which was a major refuge for most of its time period, and then all the way down to the Long Island Sound, connecting with the villages along the coast. And that was a major, it probably went all the way up to Canada. Another major trail was the Connecticut Coastal Path, which is now known as Route 1. And also a lot of our railroad systems follow major Native American trails. Then, of course, there were many minor trails, too, that actually connected to various food sources, connected each village to food sources. So it just crisscrossed Connecticut.
Mm. Now, what advice do you have when people are going out into the woods? You mentioned, again, a lot of these old trails are now part of our highway system and road system. But what should people be looking for as they're out, Lucy Ann, in either the western part of the state or the eastern part of the state?
Looking for as far
are there certain markers or important boulders that that mark where one of these trails may have come near?
Well, a lot of them actually led to major resources, and that would mean archaeology sites, which are most of those obviously are below ground. But there were also a number of ceremonial sites that were located along these trails. In fact, they're actually mentioned in much of the early English and Dutch literature on the Northeast, where Europeans actually saw Native people building these stone monuments. For example, Monument Mountain at Great Barrington is actually named for a Native American, a large stone cairn that when Native people went by, they would drop a stone on it. And actually, the Reverend John Sargent, who was the first minister to the Stockbridge Mohegans, actually asked his interpreter, who was a Mohegan Indian, why people did that. And there were a number of reasons actually given. One was to give thanks to a deity. Another one was to honor a particular person, a great person in the tribe or tribal event. So there were a number of reasons for building these large monuments. But there were a number of them in Connecticut as well. Eva Butler actually published a map that showed where a number of these were once located in the Archaeological Society of Connecticut Bulletin. Mm.
I mentioned Kevin McBride's on the phone with us, Director of Research at the Mashantucket Pequot Museum and Research Center. Kevin, tell us about your research and how you're working to learn a little bit more about these trails in your region.
Sure. Hello, Lucy Ann. How are you?
Hi, Kevin. How are you?
Good. Lucy Ann, you know, she has a good perspective on a lot of the Western trails. My particular research has been more in the looking at trails and avenues of transportation, communication within the context of Native connections to other communities, your English settlement of the Connecticut Valley, conflict, movement of English and Native soldiers in the context of the Pequot War. So, you know, we're trying to determine in the context of the Pequot War, 1636-37, with the English, Connecticut English and later Massachusetts Bay conducted a year-long war with the Pequot. There's water, transportation, obviously, and communication. And sometimes that contrasted pretty sharply with different groups. For example, the Dutch probably used mostly water along the coast and the river, whereas English were using a little bit of both. So there's some very interesting, in the context of settlement, there's some very interesting references to the Connecticut Path, which served as an avenue from Boston to the Hartford area for the very first traders. A guy named Oldham in 1633 is traveling along that trail, and he mentions he lodged every night with in an Indian village, probably Nipmuc, and then perhaps Wongong because he gets closer to the Connecticut. But that tells you that these trails probably are pretty well established. They have been established for probably thousands of years, and that their people are locating themselves, you know, along these.
Kevin, you mentioned the Pequot War. Tell us how the English may have used these trails when they did their attack on the Pequots.
Well, they certainly used Route 1 as they marched from Narragansett to Mystic, and they encountered along the way several Native features there too, a fort in Charlestown, Rhode Island, a Pequot cornfield. But we're also looking at two battles that took place on May 26, 1637, between the English and the Pequot, English and their native allies in the Pequot. One of them, a very major one, was Battle of Mystic Fort, where the English, 77 English and their native allies, attacked and burned a Pequot fortified village, killing over 400 people in a little more than an hour. What we're documenting now is what we call the Battle of the English Withdrawal from the Mystic Fort along the Mystic River, 6 miles west of the Thames River. And we've been tracking a very circuitous route the English were using, and we're tracking it by basically metal detecting and documenting hundreds of musket balls and other battle debris. And it seems to be, you know, avoiding wetlands so they don't get ambushed. And then we began to realize that it's also following a path of least resistance. We wonder if they're following an existing path or trail. No big insight there. But what we discovered recently was when we stripped away the layers of battle-related objects, we were left with about a half dozen concentrations of Pequot domestic artifacts. And
such as?
Well, such as scrap brass, trade goods, trade axes, Jesuit rings, cut up reprocessed objects. Native people would do that with brass and iron. We found hoes and mattocks and, you know, things like that. And when we put in some excavation units to test the idea that, oh, maybe these are domestic sites, we found evidence of that. And what we began to realize that were the English, the battlefield, this is because they're following an existing trail, they happen to be running over or through previous villages or domestic sites. One we know is occupied on that day and burned by the English. The others, they could have been occupied any time in the 20 to 25 years before, based on the presence of English or Dutch trade goods. So what we're looking at is this, a network of trails and paths for linking villages and communities. Now, we shouldn't be surprised by this. We always knew this in theory, but to actually see it, a half dozen of these villages, domestic sites linked by a trail is, it's pretty interesting, pretty exciting. And then now we're thinking of, we should be doing more of this to sort of discover where other domestic sites are and seeing how they're linked and where they're located.
This is Where We Live. Today we're looking at efforts to find old Native American trails and the research that's involved. On the phone with us is Kevin McBride, Director of Research at the Mashantucket Pequot Museum and Research Center. Also, Lucienne Lavin, Director of Research and Collections at the Institute for American Indian Studies in Washington, Connecticut. She's the author of Connecticut's Indigenous Peoples, What Archaeology, History, and Oral Traditions Teach Us About Their Communities and Cultures. Do you ever wonder about the trails that are in your backyard or in the woods that you like to visit? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. I wanted to take a call. Laura's calling from Tolland. Laura, you're on the show.
Hi.
What's your question?
I have a trail in my backyard that's listed on our deed as an old highway. Someone else called it an ancient highway. And right now it's just a trail the deer use mostly. But I was wondering how I would find out more about it.
That's a good question. I'll start with Lucienne. Any tips for Laura about the trail that runs through her property?
There's actually been a study of some of the old historic highways that connected Massachusetts colonies with Connecticut early on. And Kevin, I can't remember the name of who wrote it. I know it. I'm pretty sure it was a cultural resource management project through the State Historic Preservation Office. And if Kevin can remember the author of that, I'm not sure. It might have been Robert Grady. But I know there has been work on early trail systems. European trail systems that probably obviously followed Native American trail systems.
And Laura, we'll have Eric Kamerling on in just a little bit from the Connecticut Parks and Forest and Parks Association that can maybe shed some light also on what to do when you're looking for more information about a trail that runs through your property. I wanted to go back to Lucy Ann. We were talking about the Mashantucket Pequots, but there are many indigenous people that lived at one time here in Connecticut. You're on the western side of the state. Tell us more about the indigenous people there and some of the what you found and is highlighted at the research, the Institute for American Indian Studies, where you work.
Yeah, I think Kevin mentioned we sort of have different perspectives because, of course, Kevin is now focusing on Mashantucket, and I look more at intertribal relationships in western Connecticut. And, you know, one physical feature that tied them, of course, was the Housatonic River, but a lot of people don't realize that Native people did a lot of walking. They had no problem with walking. Moravian documents, the Moravians were a Protestant sect, and they had a couple of Moravian missions in Connecticut. One was at Scaticook, and another one was at the Mahican village of Wequodnock in Sharon. And they talk about Native people constantly traveling, even older women. And we know these women are old because the Moravians have baptismal records that show us when they were born and when they died and all kinds of things. So they had no problem walking, you know, 10, 15, 20 miles, and even more, the younger men and women. And what they did was they used these trails as a major social and political communication networks between, not only between their villages, but also between the villages of other tribes. There was Moravians tell us about there's a great deal of social and political meetings between the Mohican up in Stockbridge and the Scaticook, but also the Scaticook with other groups to the south, going to what the Moravians call the seashore. So we know that they use those trails for that aspect in their cultures. They also, I wanted to follow up on Kevin talking about how these trails are very old, and they are. They're probably thousands of years old, because they were also used for major Indian economic and trade systems. Native people had these trade networks thousands of years before they met the Europeans. It was just a different type of trading items with the Europeans, but they were used to trading. Mm. And we know this from archaeology that we find, and a lot of, as Kevin said, a lot of these villages are found along where some of these trails were, because they were nodes in these trading networks, trading partners. And, of course, the archaeology in Connecticut, because Connecticut is temperate, and soils are acidic, so the only thing that we usually find in the ground are imperishable objects such as stone and pottery. But Roger Williams, who was a Puritan who didn't want to be and left Massachusetts Bay, came to Rhode Island, founded Providence, and lived among the Narragansett Indians for a number of years. He actually wrote a book on them called A Key into the Language of the Americas. Williams tells us that Native people traded a lot of perishables, skins, food, wooden bowls and brooms and all kinds of things. And they would go along these trade lines. And in archaeology, we actually found a lot of materials that are made of exotic stone. The stone is not found in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. Some of the stuff, these stones have been identified geologically, and they're coming from Indiana Hornstone, from Indiana, Flint Ridge Chalcedony, from Ohio, Pennsylvania Jaspers, even Labrador Quartzite. So these are far-ranging, all the way up into the historic period. In fact, historic documents tell us how the Mohicans and other groups actually traveled all the way down to the Carolinas. for trading and for trapping during the historic fur trade connection.
Well, it's really interesting to learn about how these trails were used, the ones that may still be in existence, maybe overgrown, but they're still there and had a very important use for a lot of these indigenous people. I want to thank Lucianne Lavin, Director of Research and Collections at the Institute for American Indian Studies. That's in Washington, Connecticut. She's also an anthropologist and archaeologist. Lucianne, thank you so much for telling us a little bit about the trails today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Also, Kevin McBride, Director of Research at the Mashantucket Pequot Museum and Research Center. Kevin, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Still no state budget. Will Connecticut parks be impacted? We'll find out more after the break. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Hiking, boating, beaches. We know Connecticut parks have something for everyone. Now, lawmakers still don't have a budget. Have you wondered whether this will impact your favorite park or trail this summer? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. In studio with us now is Eric Hammerling, Executive Director of the Connecticut Forest and Park Association. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Now, Eric, I think we had a question from a listener a little bit earlier about a trail that ran through her property. Can you tell us about her question was, how does she find out more?
Sure. There's a lot of information out there. You know, obviously, Google is one of those places where a lot of people start. But there also is a state archaeologist and a state historic and preservation office. They have a ton of information. We have found out a lot about many of the Blue Blaze hiking trails, history, and coincidence with Native American trails through going right to the state archaeologist. And I would certainly recommend that as a first place to go.
You mentioned the Blue Blaze hiking trails. So when we're on those, are some of them maybe intertwined with these old Native American trails? What do we know?
Yeah, well, as your earlier guest mentioned, there's a lot that we don't know, but what we do know is that over time, the paths that are now the Blue Blaze hiking trails, and there's 825 miles of Blue Blaze hiking trails that volunteers of the Connecticut Forest and Park Association maintain all over Connecticut, and along that trail path, the trails change as landowners decide they might like to have a trail in a slightly different place or maybe off their property altogether. And we would say that those trails that have probably changed the least over time are those that are the least developable. So, for example, the Metacomet Trail or the Matabisa Trail, those ridgeline trails that were talked about earlier, those are the least developable trails and are likely those that have been in the paths where they are right now for probably thousands of years.
You've been on the show before, but for some of our listeners who may not be familiar with your organization, tell us a little bit more about what the Forest and Park Association does.
Sure. Well, the Connecticut Forest and Park Association is actually the oldest conservation organization in Connecticut. It's a private, nonprofit, membership-based organization. And we like to talk about, doing four different things. We do advocacy, we do conservation, land conservation, we do recreation, and education. The recreation is really most related to what we're talking about today with trails. And we have, volunteers who help with maintaining the 825 miles of Blue Blaze hiking trails. And also, we work and have worked since 1993 to bring Connecticut Trails Day to the state. That's actually the largest Trails Day celebration taking place anywhere in the nation. And just that weekend, the first weekend in June, there were 236 events happening throughout the state, taking people out on trails with people who know about them and can interpret them. And actually, there is a lot of events that took place on what were likely Native American trails as well.
Now, you mentioned trail maintenance. I want to know more about how, with the state budget problems, how that's impacted. You mentioned you rely heavily on volunteers.
We do. We do get some funding from state grants, and there is a small amount of federal funding that comes because those trails that I mentioned before, the Metacomet, Metabesit, and also the Monunkatuck, and up into toward the New Hampshire border. It's now a National Scenic Trail, the New England National Scenic Trail. But other than that, we really rely on, you know, members and volunteers who are spending over 20,000 hours every year out maintaining the trails. And maintaining them means they're, you know, clipping brush, they're painting blazes on trees, they're doing all the things that many people don't notice as they walk through the woods. But without those, people get lost or get hurt. So we want to keep people safe and have that outdoor experience be a great one.
Now, you mentioned the trail maintenance is important. When people pay to go into a park, they expect certain services. Could the state be doing more? And if there isn't money, could the federal government be giving more? Are we applying for the right grants to help with that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and we've often wondered that ourselves. You know, unfortunately, the state parks are 100% funded by state funding. There's no federal funding that comes to support the state parks. And even the money that you pay when you go into a state park, that money goes to the general fund. It doesn't actually go to fund the state parks. So what the state parks have to do every year is get money back from the general fund. And unfortunately, as you know, the budget has been in a cutting mode over the last several years. And because the parks are 100% reliant on the general fund, whenever there's a cut, the parks get hit hard. Just this last year, and unfortunately, you know, we see some of these cuts likely to continue. But this last year, there were four state campgrounds that were closed. Almost half of the seasonal workers who do most of the maintenance between spring and fall in the parks were cut. Hours were reduced. You know, services like having lifeguards at swimming areas, unfortunately, many of those were curtailed. So there has been an ongoing cut. You know, this year, of course, we're now at the verge of a new fiscal year. We're very concerned about what may happen again. The only saving grace for the state parks in the first quarter of the year, and you know, there's been a lot of talk about a mini budget or you know, some sort of short-term budget. The first quarter of the year happens to be the high time for people visiting parks, and there are actually more revenues that come in than the expenses to maintain them. So we're hoping that the cuts won't be as draconian at the beginning of the year.
Now, Eric, we just have a couple of minutes. There is one proposal on the table to help the parks. Can you tell us briefly about that?
Yeah, something that we've really advocated for strongly is a Passport to the Parks program. And we were happy to hear Representative Tony Walker mentioned that, you know, yesterday, and we've heard both Republicans and Democrats talk about the need to do something special to protect the parks. What the Passport to the Parks does, it would be funded through a $10 charge on your DMV registration that you do every other year. And in return for that $10 charge, you would get into the parks for free. So if you think about just, you know, one visit to, you know, one of the state beaches, which are state parks, on the weekend, that's a $13 admission. You would get, you know, for essentially $5 a year, free access to the parks, and it would generate enough funding to help to maintain them.
Well, we're still waiting to see what lawmakers will do. No budget yet, and the deadline is approaching July 1. We do want to thank you, Eric Hammerling. I guess the question with the Passport of the Parks, as the budget problem continues, will that fee be increased every couple of years? We don't know.
Well, you know, we certainly think that it probably merits that, but we would love to keep it where it is and make sure there's sustainable funding for the parks.
Well, I want to thank Eric Hammerling for joining us, Executive Director of the Connecticut Forest and Park Association. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Great to be with you, Lucy.
Our show produced by Jeff Tyson and Lydia Brown. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. Check out more about the show at WMPR.org/where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Have a great weekend.